nice to see so many people on a warm evening. And for the topic of the talk this evening, as usual, I do get suggestions for talks. Please don't give any more suggestions, because I've got a whole heap of them I'm trying to get through. But the one for this evening came about with an email somebody sent me. They've been listening to these talks online for a while. They like the philosophy, they like all the advice and where these talks take you. And so they really thought they were a Buddhist. But then they were sick and had to go to hospital in a country not Australia. And they had to fill in the forms, and part of which was, what religion are you? And they thought, well, what am I? And they just put down Christian because that's what they were born as, and they felt terrible afterwards. They thought they were actually lying to themselves. And so they wanted to know, you know, just what should one do if one starts to agree with these teachings? Is there some sort of ceremony where we convert you? We put your hands on your head and you see the light of the Buddha and then you become a Buddhist? This whole idea of conversion, which in our Western world sometimes we have to endure when people try really hard to convert us. And so that's what this talk is going to be about this evening, about conversion and what a very violent and cruel and disrespectful thing it is. What do I actually mean by that? Now, first of all, you know, I mean that sometimes why do people want to convert you? And why do we react with such negativity when they do? Because a lot of times it's not loving us for who we are, it's wanting us to be something different. What people really love is their philosophy, is their religion, is their beliefs, and they don't love people. And for me, that's something which misses the whole point of what real religions or philosophies or teachings are supposed to be giving us. You know, we love people. We don't love the names or the philosophies or the beliefs. Because this is sometimes what happens, that we do have a conflict inside of us sometimes. When we have a belief or a system which we're supposed to identify with, we're being like a Westerner or being like a socialist or a free marketeer or a Christian or a Jewish person or whatever, or a Buddhist. And we see something in somebody in front of us or a situation and we think, what would a socialist do? What would environmentalists do? What would a Christian do? And we don't need to do that, because that just, we look back into the books, into our philosophies, and we look into just how we were taught and try and gain meaning from that. You know, a lot of times you don't have to do that. All one really needs to do is put aside all one's learning, all the beliefs, all the dogma, and just open up your heart, trust in your innate wisdom, and then speak, act from there. Not from your religion, but act from your humanity and compassion. And if you did that, there would never be a need to convert anybody. You love them for who they are. A lot of times that I've taught the meaning of love and compassion, is the most important part of that is non-discriminating, unconditional, not demanding anything from the other person. And that's one of the reasons when if anybody tries to convert you, you feel a resistance there, because they're actually hating who you are instead of loving and accepting you for who you are. They want you to be different all the time. And that's exactly the same if you have a relationship with another person. And you go into that relationship just exploring each other, and the other person wants to change you into what they think, you know, their husband or their male partner should be. Try and change you into what the female partner should be. And you see, that's almost the same as like trying to convert you from one religion to another. It's not loving you, respecting you for who you are. They just want to keep changing you, for goodness sake. And you've all probably experienced that in your life, being in a relationship where you're not really accepted for who you are. They always want to change and swap you around and to make you, not even in their own image, but in the image of what they think is truth and perfection, which is what, you know, conversion was all about. Trying to make you into some image of who the person, a human being, should be. And to me that is like compulsion, coercion. And I'm very strong on human rights. I remember just recently giving a lecture at Curtin University to the human rights department. And it was obvious that if anyone has studied basic human rights, Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which most Western countries, most developed countries have signed up for, Article 19 states that everybody has the right to freedom of religion, to choose their religion or to choose no religion. That is your fundamental human right. And if it really is freedom, it has to be without coercion. Unfortunately, that we do have coercion, even in a place like Australia. And it's not a free society. And I'll tell you why. Imagine that we had a whole series of liberal schools, where to join that school, you had to be a signed up member of the LNP. And other people, maybe they'd accept a few people from the Greens or the Labour Party, but no others. And you'd also have Labour schools, where you'd send your kids, if you are a member of the ALP, the Australian Labour Party, and they will be taught socialist principles. Would you accept that in our society? That your children are brainwashed in a political view, you know, from grades 1 to 12. And of course we wouldn't. That would be a terrible situation, which is one of the people why the Liberal Party, the Labour Party and the Greens don't have their schools. There's not one Green Party school in Australia. And I think you know where I'm going with this. But how many Catholic schools are there? How many Anglican schools? How many uniting schools, Jewish schools are there in Australia? How many Buddhist schools are there in Australia? Zero. That's what makes me proud to be a Buddhist. A long time ago, people were actually trying to make a Buddhist school. Why don't we have a Buddhist school? And I say, because ethically, I cannot support that. Why is it? Because obviously, if you're going to send your kids to a Buddhist school, they're going to be coerced, maybe explicitly sometimes, but certainly implicitly. In a Buddhist school, we're going to promote Buddhism. And for the best will in the world, we're never going to give equal time and sort of equal respect to other religions. You are actually coercing your children to choosing their religion. And I always think, look, if a Buddhism is a good religion, if Christianity is a good religion, if Islam is a good religion, for goodness sake, let your children choose. But not until they're old enough to choose. Here in Australia, we have the age at which a person can vote in an election is 18. Why is that? It is because, you know, on average, you know, we think that 18 years of age, you have enough education, you have enough emotional and intellectual maturity to actually make a reasoned choice. Now imagine giving a vote to the 6-year-old. No, Liberal Party, Labour Party, Socialist Party, whatever. I mean, would it really be appropriate for a 6-year-old to vote? So we say that 18 years of age is the minimum to vote in an election. But how old do you have to be a Buddhist? How many of your kids here, you call them Buddhists, and they're underage? Have they really chosen freely? Are they able to choose freely? Is it really reasonable to call an 11-year-old a Christian or a 12-year-old a Muslim? They have not chosen. It's been chosen for them. That is an offence against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you wouldn't speak so much about it if it wasn't such a problem in our society. And because you have kids who are Christians, kids who are Muslims, kids who are Buddhists, when they're underage, they haven't really chosen at all. It means in their society, when they grow up, they take on that identification, which means that they're close to other people and causes fragmentation in our society. I've often thought of the ideal world where it doesn't matter what religion you are, you're not allowed to choose until you're 18. It doesn't matter what your parents are, you can choose when you are old enough to choose. Which means that you go out with people of all sorts of religions, you get your first boyfriend and girlfriend way before you're 18. Most of you may not tell your parents that, but you do. Which means you can go out with anybody. You can play football, you can play soccer with anybody, which means that you can learn and respect one another. We're not dividing society from such an early age into subgroups which last later on and cause a lot of misunderstandings in our world. So instead, with secular schools, they're brilliant. They are in accordance with human rights. And on a political message, because this was asked of me some couple of weeks ago, I say this because if ever you go to traditional Buddhist societies, and especially to Sri Lanka and also Burma, you may have noticed in the last 6 months or year, there has been some violence in those countries perpetrated by so-called Buddhists. Even Buddhist monks dressing up and smashing mosques and encouraging other people to violence. Now that is disgusting for me and very embarrassing. Why are they doing that? You know, one of the reasons they're doing that is their so-called grievance is that in those countries they're losing their market share of religion. And the reason is because all the other religions there, if you're a Muslim and you marry a Buddhist, the person has to convert from being a Buddhist to being a Muslim. If you marry a Christian, a Catholic, you have to say your children should be Catholics. Which means that there's too many Buddhists are actually having to convert to other religions. Why? Now, sometimes you can tell these things here. I don't want to get too much into politics, but sometimes when we talk about religious freedom, we never really think what we're talking about. A lot of times the word religious freedom is just another, it covers up what is mostly actually religious oppression. It's not freedom. Your freedom to oppress others. It sometimes goes under the cloak of religious freedom. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing? And I'm saying this because I know many people listen to these talks in power, in government. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing that in countries such as Burma or Sri Lanka, the government made a rule, a law, banning all churches, all religions, evenly, from saying and compelling in marriage that one person has to convert to the other person's religion. To make it illegal for any priest to say, I will only marry you if your children convert to my religion. Now that can be done simply because it is just being in accordance with the Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I don't care whether you're children of Buddhists or children of Muslims. When you get to your age, you choose freely. Even if your both parents are Muslims, you can choose being a Buddhist or a Christian or being a Muslim. Let you choose, for goodness sake. That is part of the freedom which is fundamental to our human world. And if we could only assert that freedom of choice and the illegality of coercion in religion or philosophy or politics, we will have a much more peaceful world when people are allowed to choose without coercion. Now I say that because a lot of governments, when I gave a talk about human rights, a lot of governments are afraid of religions, except the French government. In 2001, the French government enacted a law to restrict religious freedoms wherever they clearly contradict human rights and basic human freedoms. What they were saying is human rights and freedoms are more important than any religious dogmas. And that was actually a brilliant law to put forth. They did it. Why can't Sri Lanka or Burma or even Australia enact such a law? So that you don't get these ridiculous religious zealots knocking on your doors and just oppressing you in the shopping malls and just giving everybody a hard time. I mean, that's coercion. That's really against our freedom to come and go as we please without being so coerced. And if religions have got the goods, let them say it. And then they will be not converted, but they will be convinced. So convincing people, fine, but converting is just far too aggressive and it doesn't respect the other person. And sometimes you know that some religions, they go so far when you get to this conversion business of saying, and this is true in some places, we'll kill you unless you convert. And also it gets so gross, maybe not here in Australia yet, but in other countries, I know that when I go to Malaysia, it's so common over there, and also in Singapore as well. You get these Buddhists, you know, they're dying, they're in the hospital on their deathbed, only got a little while to go. And some, it's usually the Christians, they come in there with their pastor and they say, oh, we're going to convert you, otherwise you're going to go to hell, you must be converted. And they keep on harassing this poor old person who's dying. And that's really gross. But I've been telling people, my method of avoiding that. If that is, you know, for the Malaysians and Singaporeans here or listening overseas, if that happens to you, you know, if you're on your deathbed as a Buddhist and maybe you've got a son who's got into these born-again Christian movements and they come with their pastor and they harass you to convert to being a Christian. Convert. And that means they'll leave you alone. And as soon as they've left you alone and got out of the hospital ward, then you can convert back again to being a Buddhist. One of the nice things about being a Buddhist, it's so practical. You can convert one way, you can convert the other way. And that works. But the whole idea of, again, trying to convert somebody, what actually is it? I mean, many of you, you know, who are here, you never started off as Buddhist in this world, and that's fine. You don't have to start off as a Buddhist. I never started off as a Buddhist. Now, actually, my father was an atheist, and the reason why he was an atheist, whenever I asked him about religion, you know, he grew up in Liverpool during the Second World War. And he told me he saw so many people with their limbs blown off. People died terrible deaths. And sometimes, you know, we look at what happens in these war-torn areas of the world today, and we forget that some people in the even the 80s or 90s now, they actually saw that, they witnessed that. where they didn't have such great medical care. You didn't have Medivac. You didn't have all this organization rushing to the wounded and injured. They just had to scream and die in agony. When my father saw that during the Second World War, he said, after what he'd seen, he could never believe in a God who would allow such things, who would be loving enough to allow such things. And that was a fair argument. I can't agree with that because I've never seen it. I can never contradict it either. But at least, you know, that was, you know, his view. But still a very good man. And so that's the area which I grew up in. But I also remember when I was 16, realizing that religion is important. You know, to have a philosophy, a spirituality, if you don't want to like the word religion, a spirituality which gives you meaning, which is much more than your science. Now, I was a scientist, but that wasn't enough to really explain. It can explain maybe just, you know, how this world began in the Big Bang. It can explain how a TV or computer works. But there's much more to life than that. It can never explain love. And just know how you can really connect with another person and they can feel you, you can feel them in a really deep level. You would never be able to explain that, no matter just how much quantum physics you studied. You just couldn't sort of get your handle on things like fear or anger or dreams or hopes or some of those inspirations which make people do incredible things like a Mandela. How can you explain that through science? There's so much which you couldn't explain, and that was for me the part of the spiritual world. Religion, if you like, philosophy, the emotional professors of the world were for me, you know, the spiritual icons. And I really wanted to learn about that. So when I did manage to get a school prize, because I did come from a poor, I know everyone says they were poor, it's one of those things for most people, is a badge of honor. But I really was poor. And so when I got my school prize, I could actually buy some books. And instead of buying a book on mathematics, which is what I won my first school prize on, I went to the bookshop and bought books on all the different religions. Because I wanted to actually to find out which suited me. Not which is the best. Never think which one is the best. Think what suits you. What food is the best? And you all know what you think is the best, but it's not what I think is the best. So just like food, spirituality has to be suited each individual. So I got all the books on the different religions. I read them all. These days, I tell people that was market research. Like anything else, you're going to get a car. What do? You don't just buy the car which your father got. You don't just buy a Holden because you live in Australia. You won't be able to buy a Holden soon, what I read in his papers, the car getting out of Australia. But what you do, and what everybody, what is the best car for you? And that's what I did with religion. I just choose. I never realized just how fortunate I was to have the freedom to choose. That I could just pick up books and choose, yeah, this one, that one, this one, and actually choose the one which I thought was the best. Would you like to give that choice to others? To your children? Because I know there's many people here who are traditional Buddhists and who get very upset if their child becomes a Christian. You should not. It's their choice. Let them research, make a decision and choose. If they make the wrong choice, they can change again afterwards. You don't have to be a Christian and then forever. You can convert back and forth if you like. You can be a Buddhist on Waisak Day, a Christian on Christmas, a Muslim on Eid. That way you can enjoy all the ceremonies and have a great time in life. But what you are doing, you're making a choice by yourself. And sometimes you make wrong choices. You can choose back again. One of the reasons I chose Buddhism is because Buddhism allows you to choose, which is a wonderful thing. It was mature enough as a religion not have anybody converting you at all. In fact, I do remember how hard it was to become a Buddhist. And in this magazine story, I told this to Colleen, who did the story on me last week in the West Australia, but she didn't put it in, but it was, I remember thinking about it again, because I just read a book by Professor Rupert Sheldrake, where this mate of mine, he was quoted a few times. He became one of my best mates, you know, when I was at university. So, okay, I just read some books, I thought, Buddhism is who I am. It's not that you converted to anything, it just described who I was at that stage of my life. These principles of free inquiry, I thought there was a reincarnation, I never thought of one life, didn't make any sense to me. So these were the things, the law of karma, to take responsibility, that whatever you do, no one will punish you, you will punish yourself, because you know what you did, you won't feel good about what you did if it was hurtful to someone else. If it was kind, generous, you get that back straight away. I could feel that. So this was actually fat me to like a glove. But when I was growing up, I never knew any other Buddhists. You know, from 16 to 18, I thought I was the only Buddhist in the whole world. Until I went to this big university. And if you go to a university, it's not just about studying, it's the social life as well. And that's probably what I learned the most at university, the social life. In those days, you didn't have to study very much. But part of the social life was joining clubs. And they had this society's fair in those days. And that society's fair, they had like all the clubs you could ever think of were there. From the Fox Hunting Society, to Tiddlywinks, to, you know, the Flat Earth Society. Just anything weird you had there. But one of the first things I saw was the Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. And that was just like, wow, there are other Buddhists. And I went straight up there and I said, I want to join. And the guy in the counter, this isn't a usual Buddhist, said, you don't have to join. Just come to a talk and see if you like it. And I got up and I want to join, I'm already a Buddhist. You don't have to. Listen, come and see first of all. And I thrust this pound note into this guy's hand. I am joining. Sorry. Take it. And that young student, he's called Professor Bernard Carr. He was Professor of Physics at London University. And he was also, he shared my interest in psychic phenomena as well. He was also a member of the Cambridge University Psychic Research Society and the London Psychic Research Society. We'd go out searching for ghosts and anything weird and psychics, go to hypnotists. To this day, he's a close friend of mine, Bernard. And he was actually mentioned in Professor, what's his name, Sheldrake's book. And that's why it came to my mind, where we first met. That was typical of Buddhists. They don't try and convert you. It's actually the opposite. They try and keep you away. This is like, here, you come and join up. No, no, don't join up this week. You don't have to become a member. Just keep on coming and just see if you like it or not. Actually, you know, I'm supposed to, where's the assistant secretary? She keeps on telling me, come on, join up, join up, join up. We need more members. But that's a nice thing about this. It is so open and accepting. You don't have to be a Buddhist to come to this joint. Now, what was it during the Range Retreat? You had Archbishop Herft up here giving a talk. Now, that's the sort of beauty which I like about spirituality. You don't try and convert anybody. You respect them. You learn from them. And, you know, let people try and convince you. You try and convince other people. Because in that debate, in that discussion, that's where we learn so much. And it's not about trying to change anybody. It's just trying to help each other. To make the world a better place for each other person. I don't care what you call yourself. Now that is the type of spirituality which would be such a beautiful thing in our world. Not just trying to sort of get upset and angry at each other. You're a Buddhist, you're a Muslim, we must hate each other. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we never ever had this idea of having to convert each other? which is a total disrespect, a hatred, a cancer, which infects the great religions of our world. Instead we have, no, that would be banned by law, by our preachers, by our leaders. Conversion, no. Respect, learning from, growing together, just seeing just how much we can learn from one another. Now that is the total opposite of conversion. We were just, I think we did it today, every year we have the Benedictine monks from New Norcia come to our monastery, or we go to their monastery. It's their turn to come and visit us. So I think one of our monks was just arranging the times to come and visit Bodhinyana Monastery. And these are the Catholic monks, and these are the Buddhist monks. And you wouldn't believe how well we get on together. No, you wouldn't, because SBS, they videoed our meeting once. So we're doing a program. Unfortunately, they only showed about 10 seconds or 20 seconds of this whole interaction between the Benedictine monks and the Buddhist monks, which was a great shame. Because I remember the cameraman at the time. Now he was, no, not the interviewer, the cameraman was watching us discussing things and being really good mates. And he said, "It's incredible. I've never seen anything like this before. These are leaders of two religions and they're just like brothers, best friends, mates, the sort of people who go out to the pub together." Of course, I would never do that, but you know, they do. That's the only difference we have. No, they turn water into wine, we turn the wine back to water. That's the only difference we have. And there's never any idea of trying to convert each other. Because to me, conversion is saying, "I hate you, I disrespect you, you are wrong, and I am right." Okay, it goes to the classic Buddhist story, you know, of how to deal with these things. I'll do it very, very quickly because it's such a famous story, the seven blind men and the elephant. Although that these days, and I've told that story so many times, it's in the book. Let's change it. The seven blind men and the kangaroo. Once there are, see if I can manage this. Seven blind men and a kangaroo. And blind men, never been to Australia before, never seen a kangaroo. And so they heard kangaroo. What is a kangaroo? And so they all decided to try and find a kangaroo, each, feel it, and then find out what a kangaroo was. And the first person felt the tail. They'd never seen a kangaroo before. They said, "Oh, a kangaroo is like a snake." Because that's what it feels like. You feel that. A very nice furry snake. And the one who felt the paws said, "No, it's a boomerang. It's bent in the middle." And the one who felt the little joey in the pouch said, "Its head, not like an ordinary person, the head of a kangaroo is in the tummy." That's what they felt. And they said, no, it's got this huge body just like a boulder. And it's got these two leaves which keep moving backwards and forwards. You know, that's what a kangaroo is. And so they came back together and they argued what a kangaroo is. "It's a boomerang. No, it's a snake. No, it's an animal which has got a head in the middle. No, its head is in the top." And they argued. And now that is the problem with religion. They argue. The alternative, which is based on this, the original story, is that they combine their experience. And then they'll find, a kangaroo has got a snake in the back, it's got a head in the middle and a head in the top, it's got paws like two boomerangs, and two leaves on the top which keep moving around. Okay, and it's a much closer description of what a kangaroo is. Now, we're talking about that in the monastery, and I told people that there was another adaptation of that, which actually, I told this actually to Julia Gillard and Wayne Swan at Hayman Island a few years ago, and they laughed. It didn't do any good. But it was the adaptation of the seven blind elephants. Do you know that adaptation? Because once there were seven blind elephants. And they'd always heard this thing, a man, a man. What is a man? Because they'd never seen one before. So they'd heard this story from the Buddhists, you know, about the seven blind men and the elephant. So they said, this is how we can find out what a man is. Let's all find a man each, feel a man, and then come back and compare notes. So they all went out, found a man, felt it. When they came back, they all agreed, men were flat. That's the only way that elephants could feel someone by squashing them. But at least it gets the point of let's not argue, because when you're converting somebody else, you don't even respect them enough to ask them, who are you? What are you? What are your beliefs? And when it's people of religion who are not going around converting, but going around listening, it's amazing what we can learn from one another. And we can actually become better human beings when we learn from one another. Okay, the Muslims get a bad rap, but there's one part of Islam which I really love and respect, which is the Sufis. And that's a traditional part of Islam. And these Sufis were incredible, and they're really wise. I forget the great poet like Rumi was a Sufi. Brilliant poet. And they have one of my heroes in spirituality was a guy called the Mullah Nasruddin. Now, you all know about the mullahs in Iran. They're supposed to be really mean, you know, making sort of nuclear weapons in secret. Whatever it is they're supposed to be doing, they've got a very bad reputation. But this Mullah Nasruddin, he was absolutely brilliant and wonderful. He was so funny. I mean, one of the stories I read about him, please excuse me, this is not me, I'm just reporting a story. In his village, there was a very holy man. And he was so holy, everyone respected him, they went to him for counseling and wise advice, and he was the real thing, the real goods. So when he got sick, they all clubbed together to get the best doctor to try and heal his sickness. Unfortunately, it was one of these sicknesses which doctors couldn't heal at all. He was dying. So the whole village had a big meeting. What are we going to do? Our guru, our teacher is about to die. What can we do? And this one fellow put up his hand. I've got a great idea. I hereby sacrifice 3 days of my life. Now God, Allah, please give 3 days of my life. Cut my life short 3 days and give it to our holy teacher. And they all thought, wow, what a great idea. Someone else put their hand up. I give 7 days of my life. To extend. I give 10 days of my life. And this Mullah Nasruddin put his hand up. I give 20 years. I said, what? 20 years? I mean, look, think about this. No, said, I thought about it, I give 20 years. That's a lot of your life to give to this great monk who's about to die. He said, oh no, I give 20 years of my wife's life. All those people laughing are misogynists. I did not. But then, well, that's a funny story. But the deep story he gave, which was actually my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, was his favorite story. And he said, once he found this Mullah Nasruddin, he was eating chilies. And he had a whole pile of chilies, maybe even 30 or 40 of them. And his face was red. You know, snot was coming out of his eyes, his nose, and probably his eyes as well. You know what it's like when you eat too many chilies? You're crying, you're sneezing, you go really red. And he was still putting another chili in his mouth. And his friends go, what are you doing? And this Mullah Nasruddin said, I'm looking for the sweet one. Now that is so powerful about your life. So, isn't that the case? We're looking for the sweet one. Or always looking for the next cricket match when you will win. I'm looking for the sweet one. And you end up crying so many times. Looking for the perfect partner in life. And how many times have you cried and snot come out of your nose and other stuff? Always looking for the sweet one in life. Chilies are hot. Okay, relationships are hot. Some people like it, they're spicy, yes, but you're going to cry. So get real. That's the trouble, always looking for the sweet one. There are no sweet ones, their chili's okay. Looking for the perfect girl, you know, they're girls, okay. And they're going to make you cry. Guys, they're the same. There is no sweet one. They're all hot. They're going to make you cry. But that's a brilliant story. That comes from Islam. So you can't say that just one religion's got, you know, all the franchise on truth and no one else has. That's why the whole idea of conversion is just, to me, just sucks. You know, what are you doing that for? That shows you have very little understanding what spirituality is, what truth is, what love is, what respect is. It's one of the reasons why that if people don't do that, governments, please legislate so that everybody in Sri Lanka at any age has the choice what religion they want to be. Doesn't matter what their parents are. And that is supported totally by the government. Because sometimes you do need governments to intervene to actually to protect society from religion. That's why religious freedom is just a myth. It is just religious domination in the guise of freedom. I did read the newspapers about the ACT had tried to get freedom for people who were gays to marry, marriage equality, struck down by the High Court because the federal government decided to get involved. What on earth is the federal government doing? Deciding on who can get married and who can't get married. Sometimes the governments, they restrict freedoms. They should never be able to do that. It's going to come eventually anyway. New Zealand are there. The Kiwis are ahead of Australia. Should be bloody embarrassed. But all of these things over here, that a lot of times it's religions are behind this. When it gets down to it, not so much the politicians, but the religions are behind all this sort of stuff. And being a religious person, a leader of Buddhism in Australia, I say that we should do something to restrict religious freedoms when they are misused to coerce and to prevent freedoms for others. Why not? Okay, that's a bit political. It's really social rather than political. Trying to give a better society in our world. And you know, if that happened in Sri Lanka, there would be no need for those monks to go smashing down, you know, other sort of religions, places of worship. Because it would be freedom. Just let's have a free marketplace of religion. Okay, where no one has an advantage because government support or because of violence or whatever. So people can choose freely. So that's why that people can not just choose freely, but respect freely. You know, whenever there is a free marketplace, every supplier of those goods in the marketplace, they have to increase, you know, their product. They make it more acceptable. They have to become better. If we had a free choice of religion, the Christians would have to actually up their game. So would the Muslims. If there was freedom to choose what religion you were going to follow, people wouldn't accept, say, the discrimination against women in Muslim societies. They would not accept that if they had freedom to choose. If you have that freedom to choose, the whole of society would become a much better society because they'd have to. The competition would mean every company, in this case religions, would have to increase their game and be more responsive to the society which they're trying to draw their members from. Okay, this is an economic sort of metaphor for religions, but you can see it does actually work. It's one of the reasons I came here to Australia, and you just can't just teach like you do in Thailand where I got trained. You've got to be responsive. Keep the original beautiful teachings of freedom and peace and respect and love, but put them in a way where people can actually understand them, get inspired. Now, what people really want these days is inspiration, because so much other stuff in the world It's just not inspiration, it's the opposite, desperation. Desperation, you know, with politics, desperation with corruption, desperation with an economic system which has no care for the environment and which doesn't care about other people either. Sometimes we become so disinspired. And what a wonderful thing it is to actually to get people just inspiring us again, giving leadership, seeing a better future. Why not? And this is one way of doing it. So take away all this coercion and just have a real freedom, a democratization of religion. So conversion is not there anymore. In the same way that when you choose a partner in this world, don't try and convert them to being certainly not your religion. I'm very proud of one disciple who lives in Singapore, whose wife is a Muslim, and who's got one child who's a Christian, and a second child who's a Hindu. I'm really encouraging them to get a third child, make them a Jew, so they can have the full set. But it's true. He was a Buddhist, married to a Muslim, two children, one a Hindu, one a Christian. Isn't that brilliant? Why not? If we respect each other, it can happen. So, I'm sure you've got friends who are Christians and Hindus and Muslims, hopefully, in this multicultural society. Wouldn't it be great if we all had those friends? What type of world do you want to leave for your children? Want to convert everyone to being a Buddhist? No way. In a garden, you need flowers of many different species to make a beautiful garden. In our world, we need people of many different species, many different races, religions. I'm going to finish off with one of my favorite stories. This is from Open the Door of Your Heart. It's a metaphor, the simile of the old man and the violin. There was once an old man lived up in the mountains in a very, very remote and poor village. Like many fathers, he sacrificed everything for his children and for their education. He worked extra in other people's fields to save money to send the kids to good schools and eventually to universities. And the children did so well, they all got jobs, lawyers, doctors, businesses in the city. And once the children got settled, they thought they wanted to invite their father to visit the city for the first time. Just like I know there's many, so Sri Lankans, maybe Malaysians, maybe Bangladesh, really work hard here. When you get settled, you invite your parents over to actually to see, you know, what a city like Perth is. So this old man saw things he'd never ever seen before in the poor village where he grew up. But what happened one day, he was passing a house and he heard a terrible sound. It was the worst noise he'd ever heard in his life. But even though he wanted to run away from that terrible cacophony of noise, his sense of, curiosity was so strong, he followed the noise to its source. And there in the back room of a house, he saw this young boy, maybe 7 years of age, trying to play a violin. Screech, scratch. It was such an awful sound. And being uneducated, this man thought, that is what violins sound like. And he never wanted to hear a violin ever again. Next day, another part of town, he heard a very beautiful sound. He followed that to its source. And you've probably run ahead of me already. He found that was coming from this old woman who was also playing a violin. But obviously, she'd been practicing her whole life. And she was now a maestro. And the sound she drew out of that violin was so beautiful The old man realized it was not the violin's fault. It was just that the young boy hadn't learned to play it yet, while the old woman had. And he realized that's the same with religions in our world. You know, some people don't know how to play their religion yet. Whether it was the Burmese monk on the front cover of Time magazine a few months ago, whether it's a Christian fundamentalist or a Muslim jihadist, they haven't learned how to play their religion. They make an awful sound. But if you, like me, are seeing people who are maestros of their religion, no matter what the religion are, you realize it's not the religion's fault. It's the person hasn't learned how to play it yet. That's all. But the story has a third day. The next day, this old man was going in another part of the city where he heard the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his whole life. Far better than the maestro playing the violin. Far sweeter than the sound of the birds in the mountains where he lived in the early morning. Just more calming than the sound of the mounting streams after a rainfall. For him it was the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard. What was that sound? Yeah, that was boring to you. You were right, it was an orchestra. And the reason why was because every member of that orchestra, every member was a maestro of their instrument. And number two, and most importantly, they'd all learned, having mastered their own instrument, how to play together in harmony. Wouldn't that be the greatest music in our world? No matter what religion you are, stop trying to convert the woodwind to being a piano player. Instead, let's each learn our instrument so well. Whatever religion, faith, part of Buddhism, I don't care. And then, let us all learn how to play together in harmony. What a beautiful world that would be. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so now we've got some questions and comments from that talk. All sorts of stuff. A bit of politics, a bit of social action, a bit of inspiration. See what we get next. We've got some questions first from overseas. Okay, we lost it. Okay. This has probably been heard by, was it ACO, because I did mention jihad. So this is probably, someone's hacked in to it already. Okay, from Thailand first of all. Dear Ajahn, since we believe that death is not a sad event, what should we say to a friend or co-worker when we hear about the death of a member of their family? Woohoo! No, don't say woohoo, they might not understand. I don't want to follow the conventional light. At the same time, I'm afraid that my lack of sympathy is not an appropriate manner in our society. I ask this question because I'm at an age where one goes to a funeral several times a year. Okay, remember, you are talking to the person. You're not talking about your philosophy. So if a person, another family member, they just lost somebody, you talk to that grief which that person has. So you forget about your philosophy. Or if your philosophy is just kindness. If that person hasn't got grief, which happens often when people die, and to say, oh, just well done. We all have to die one day. You know, you've let go. Brilliant. So speak to the person. Don't speak from your philosophy. And, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, we have this culture of grief in our society. And I remember first encountering this myself with Princess Diana. I was on retreat when she died, in the monastery, having a nice peaceful time. Everyone was happy when I went into retreat. When I came out, the whole world was crying. They didn't even know her. Not related, not the same family, not even the same country. And I couldn't believe, what on earth are you crying about Princess Diana for? Oh, it's so sad. It was just totally media-driven. And being a monk, you can actually see that. And I've seen, it's not just me, it's our culture. We have a culture of grief and crying. I did see a few photos of Nelson Mandela's funeral. South Africans have got their act together. They were dancing and celebrating. And they did that to celebrate a great man. Wouldn't that be a better thing to do? So actually we're changing the culture. Changing the culture of grief to the culture of respect. Respecting a person. And so, when I die, anyone who cries makes bad karma. You've heard it from me, so please respect me. Don't cry. I've already given my instructions when I die. As soon as I die, no funerals, no cremations or burials. That's too expensive. The yellow recycling bin. It gets from service time every Friday, really cheap, and just go into landfill. Much better, because you go to Karakata, it's already full, hardly any space there. Burning, it's just too much gases into the atmosphere. So yellow recycling bin, that's where I want to go. So you could actually, and I see when I've been to funerals, very often, we have funerals in here as well. When we have funerals, I've seen kids. Well, kids playing around, being exuberant like all young children are. And I've seen them go up to their daddy or mummy and look at them and see the grief on their mummy's face. And I've seen that kid just get so confused and learn from their parents that at funerals you're supposed to cry. I've seen it so often, I know where your grief comes from. It's culturally conditioned. You've been brainwashed to think that's what you should do when somebody dies, and now you can't stop it. It's become automatic. There's no need for that. Grief is what you add onto loss. It's not inherent in loss. So unfortunately, you come from Thailand. Unfortunately, especially where this lady comes from in Bangkok, they've totally lost the understanding of death. Anyway, from Australia, oh my goodness, is there a relationship between, this is Sila Anusati, which is just remembering your precepts, your virtue, and the meditation on compassion. All meditations are connected. There's always a relationship between these things, but sometimes we focus on one part of things, and we sort of just omit the other part of things. So there's a relationship, but that's a huge question, and not really nothing to do with my talk on conversion. Anyway, from Sri Lanka, I am the only son in our family. I am an undergraduate. I hate being busy with my studies. What should I do to love my studies? Thank you. Again, if you study something which is really interesting to you, of course you love your studies. But not if you don't have interest in it now. Just put interest into it. Whatever you do in life, you can always make it interesting and fascinating. And it's not the subject itself. If you're doing like accounting or something, make it interesting. Have fun with the numbers. Count the numbers backwards. In other words, usually we have 1,000,264. It's always from left to right. Start writing it the other way around, from right to left. And no one can understand your calculations because they start from the other end. You're just playing around, making it interesting, and having a huge amount of fun. When you add things up, start from the bottom of the page and go to the top or whatever. When you do things which are fun, you're not making it boring, you're making it interesting, and you're being innovative, and you will find if you are innovative like that, it's amazing just the sorts of things you'll discover, and your studies will not just be learning what other people have done. You've been experimenting, innovating, taking it further. Which is what life is all about. The thing with universities, they just tell you what to do. You learn what that you told, and then you pass the examinations. Yeah, you've got to do that to pass the examinations, but do more than that. That's what I did at university when I was an undergraduate. I was actually told, yeah, we've got this great university. You're studying maths at first, the first year. That's not enough. Go to architecture, go to ancient Greek, go to whatever, and just, you know, make use of all these great minds and resources at this university. And for me then, learning became this incredible, wonderful exploration. I had a whole great university, you know, as my playground. And imagine when you call it a playground, you've got so many different swings and slides to go on, and it was, didn't have enough time to fit it all in. That made it alive. So, yeah, whatever subject you're doing, really take it up. Make it interesting. Challenge it. Read something totally different than your subject. And it really, really becomes fascinating and alive. I was really highly motivated at university because the lecturers, they just said things which were outrageous, which later turned out to be true. And that was the brilliance, throwing out crazy ideas. I remember this one professor, Professor Fred Hoyle. He's a professor of physics. He was a Lucasian professor of physics at Cambridge when I was there. The same chair is now held by Stephen Hawking. And I went to a lecture, it was the 100th anniversary of the chemistry laboratories or whatever. And they had this lecture. It was just like, you know, when you listen to the Rolling Stones, there's always a band which goes first. The guy who went first was the guy who discovered quasars, another brilliant Nobel laureate. And then we had the main act, Professor Fred Hoyle. Now, this was the biggest lecture theatre in Cambridge. I was so lucky that I got the time wrong. I went there 1 hour early, which is why I could get a seat. Now, you know, if the Rolling Stones were performing there, they wouldn't get more people going in. It was electric. It was incredible, the best lecture I've ever been to. And this guy was throwing out all these ideas, which just made you boggle. And, you know, people who were studying classics, studying ancient Latin were there as well. And this guy could really lecture and inspire you. And I remember one of the things he was saying there, you know, I remember this from such a long time ago, was saying these so-called physical constants, such as the speed of light, or the universal gravitational constant. He said, why are they constant? Who said they should be constant? And he was challenging everything. And he was just throwing these out. And I forgot about these until that book I mentioned earlier by Rupert Sheldrake, The Delusion of Science, he calls it. And they're basically taking away all consciousness and having scientific dogma. And Big G does change. So it seems, does the speed of light. All these assumptions which science is based on are just dogmas. They're not true. And there is more evidence, say, that consciousness is independent of the brain than there is for the existence of the Higgs boson, which was so-called discovered recently, and people got Nobel Prize for that. Why? Because it fits the dogma. But is it true? Did they discover the Higgs boson, or did they create it themselves? These are the questions which great scientists actually ask. Totally turns up over what you learn in universities, which is why people get dull at universities. Why people get dull when you go to sermons by religions. Throw up ideas. Get inspired. See things in a different way. Challenge. Now, I challenge today the idea of religious freedom. What does it really mean? Why do we just say religious freedom, let religions do whatever they want? Challenge that. Is that a good idea? Should we have religious freedom or freedom from religions? Hee hee hee. So if you do things like that in Sri Lanka, then go to university and it's just mind-blowing. You get people not just repeating what everyone else has learnt, but throwing out new ideas. Not to teach you what to know, but teach you how to find out. That is learning. Anyway, there we go. So, I'm not sure if I answered your questions, but that's the best you're getting. Anyone here? Any questions? Okay, Eddie. There's always a question from Eddie.
Chan Brahm, no?
Yes,
in fact, the Buddha, you know, He did warn us, you know, or cautious us against people converting us, you know, and he encouraged us to use our internal wisdom, you know, to judge and believe things, you know. He said, "Ehi pasiko, come and see, come and experience, you know. Do not believe what people say, not even himself, the Buddha, you know. Only after careful analysis, you know, that it makes sense to you, then you believe it, you know." He said his teaching is about experience. He said you can't see his teaching through logical reasoning or through intellectual discussion or through reading books. Only after internal, you know, experience, you know, from his teaching, you know. Okay? All right? Yeah. That makes sense to you.
It makes sense, but... How do you know what is truth and what is not truth?
It's only after...
Remember who's giving the sermon tonight, Eddie.
I was just sharing, sorry, Ajahn Brahm.
Okay, sorry. I apologize. Sorry.
That's what he said, you know. His teaching is about intel, and you become a Buddhist not through conversion, through your own free will.
Exactly. Now, that's the most important thing you said. It has to be your own free choice.
And that's such an important thing. You have the free choice of what political party you choose, what cricket team or football team you support. You have all these free choices, but why is it? You know, just that in religion, you have to follow your parents or your nation. That's just like, how many people, just because your mum and dad support the West Coast Eagles, does that mean you have to follow the West Coast Eagles too? That's a football team in Western Australia. And what will happen? Your mum and dad support the West Coast Eagles, and you support the Fremantle Dockers, that's the other type. Would that mean that they would try and convert you, and they would take you to a re-education camp, and they would slap you around and say, no, you can't support the Dockers anymore? But the only football team is the West Coast Eagles. That's ridiculous, isn't it? When you make a metaphor like that. So it has to be the free choice, which would mean... Why can't we have that free choice? I think it's because some religions are afraid of freedom. Buddhism isn't. So let it be free. If your religion is the best, then your children should be able to see that for themselves. Don't force them. Give them the freedom. I never mentioned this, but this is an old little thing, that one monk over in UK was asked, by this English mum and dad, they've just given birth to a son, how should we bring up our child? Should we make them a Buddhist? Or should we just not even mention religion to them? Or should we take them to all the different religions? Help! What should we do? And this monk gave some very good advice. He said, just encourage your child, number one, to be honest, and number two, to question. Because if you encourage your child to be honest, they're not just speaking honestly to others, being honest to themselves, so they will never settle on any view or any truth inside themselves. It doesn't make sense. They won't lie to themselves. If a religion doesn't make sense, they're not going to lie to themselves that it does make sense. And questioning is keep questioning and questioning and keep test everything until you find out, yes, this is the truth. So through questioning and honesty, you are empowering your children to find out what is the best religion. You're not telling them, you're giving them the tools. If they keep questioning, and they don't stop until they've found an answer which is honest to them and honest to their experience, then you're equipping them to find the way. And if they choose that's Islam, fine. They've been questioning, they've been honest. If it's Buddhism, fine. But always question and always be honest to your experience, to life, and to yourself. Great advice on how to bring up kids. Okay, thank you, Eddie, for that.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
So I think that's enough for tonight. We're going a bit late, so thank you all for coming. And I will be here again next Friday, and then I won't see you again till... Oh, no,
I did actually mention that for those of you, it's getting to the holiday time now. On New Year's Eve, to keep you on the straight and narrow, so you can go to a party with no booze or alcohol or drugs. Every New Year's Eve on the 31st of December, we have Ajahn Brahm's party. And you're all invited from 9 o'clock till 12:15, a holy way to bring in the new year. Lots of fun, no booze. No BYOs either, please. So that's, if you haven't been before, Ajahn Brahm's party, 31st of December, here in this lovely centre. So let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then you can go and do whatever you need to do.